Nettoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us on the new episode of the Calcio Land podcast. So tonight we're going to talk a little bit on what we saw between Roma and Liverpool, what that means for Italian teams in the Champions League. We're going to preview the weekend in Serie A with our friend Thousand Names, coming off his first appearance on the actual podcast. We're going to get to your fantastic Twitter questions. We had some good ones since we didn't get to answer them on Monday. And we're going to end the podcast with a great interview with our friend Grant Wall, who we haven't had on for quite some time. We're going to talk about some interesting topics with him, including Balotelli and MLS, and about his new book, which is really outstanding, Masters of Modern Soccer, which I just finished and I think you guys will enjoy. But before we get to all this, I am joined by our great friend, co-host, producer, Alex Goldberg. And I wanted to simply ask you, Alex, what was your takeaway from the showdown between Roma and Liverpool?
All right, David. Well, my takeaway, I first need to preface before I give it. John Solano, great friend of the show. If you're listening, I mean no disrespect by this take. I know you've had a rough last 24 hours. Hopefully this will not add to it. But honestly, my takeaway with the Roma-Liverpool game from yesterday is Roma did not deserve to win. I know there's a lot of talk about the missed calls and there needs to be VAR and the referee sucked. I get that and I totally agree. VAR needs to be implemented in the Champions League. It's especially hard for a team like Roma that has VAR in Serie A and then doesn't have it in the Champions League. I get that. But I need to kind of move away from the decisions that were made or weren't made. Roma had the wrong attitude coming into this leg. They just did. It reminded me of their quotes ahead of the Barcelona tie, saying, we're playing with house money. We've gotten this far. That's great. Already that's kind of admitting, we're probably not going to win. It's not the greatest attitude, in my opinion. I got their sentiment, but I still don't love the attitude. But then again, they come into this second leg. Yeah, they're down 5-2, but they're coming into the second leg with the same exact attitude I felt. Whatever. It's not going to happen again. Lightning doesn't strike twice. We're not going to be able to do it. And I think that carried over to the pitch. Right from the start of the game, Raja Nainggolan, a player that I really like, with a woeful turnover that led to Mane's goal. That's a terrible, terrible way to start. And then Liverpool's second goal by Wijnaldum on the corner. This is my biggest pet peeve in the sport. Maybe my biggest pet peeve. I'm getting caught up clearly in my emotion, but I hate when defenders quit on the play, look to the line judge or the referee, and throw their hand up asking for offsides. I hate that. Oh, I hate that. They immediately gave up on the play. Not only did they call for offsides, but they also were complaining about Van Dijk giving one of them a little push. Grow up. It's a physical sport, especially in the box. There's a lot of tugging and pulling on every corner kick. If every foul was called, you would never be able to take a corner kick. You just wouldn't be able to. So they had a terrible approach and attitude on the two Liverpool goals. And yes, I'm not going to deny Roma was definitely on the wrong side of probably two calls, or you could say non-calls. The first one being Dzeko getting tripped up by Karius, and then the second one clearly being a handball by Alexander Arnold. But also the penalty at the end of the game that Under forced on Liverpool, that wasn't really a handball. So at least if you implement VAR, they're going to at least cancel out the handballs. You'll still get one penalty. You'll just get it at a different time. Maybe Dzeko still gets his penalty, and yes, then if he makes it, it is tied. But overall, depending on the refs to be perfect or complaining about VAR after the fact is not the best way to go. They didn't believe. They didn't believe. They had that belief once they were playing against Barcelona. Still didn't love the quotes leading up to the Barca game, but I got it. As I said, I get the fact that they think they're playing with house money. But once they were on the pitch and they were making the comeback in the second leg versus Barca, there was a belief. There was a lack of belief yesterday against Liverpool. And in my opinion, that's slightly shameful. It is. But nonetheless, good job by Roma. They really did perform very well in the Champions League, but I just can't be too upset if I'm a Roma fan because I first have to point the finger at Roma, not the referees. So that's my takeaway, David. Some people may not love it, especially Roma fans, but that's what I got. What about you?
I love the passion, Alex. Really an exciting take on that. And look, John's already been busy taking on all of Liverpool Twitter, so I think he'll be ready to DM you right after he hears this. He's pretty fired up, as people have seen. So yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said. For me, you know, I'm with you. I think the result, how on an aggregate it was 7-6, you know, isn't really a reflection of what happened. But I say this in two ways. A, I think Liverpool showed they were, I'm not going to say clearly, but that they were the better team by a pretty significant margin. But also because of the penalty decisions and whatnot, the score could have been very different. And I say that on both sides. Even Liverpool had some questionable calls. Roma did as well. I'm with, you know, what Palotta and Monchi have said. At this point, we really need VAR in these situations. There's really so much at stake in these matches that it would be great if at least we had that. And look, you know, it's far from perfect in Serie A. I think there's definitely some things that can be improved on it. But I, you know, once you're used to competition that has it, to go back to one that doesn't is a little bit weird. One thing that I really enjoyed, some positive takeaways, is Monchi's statement, you know, who tied it also to what happened with Juve, with Real Madrid, that it's time for Italian teams to speak up and be, you know, try to, I'm not saying get preferential treatment, but just kind of be on a more level playing field. Interesting, especially because Monchi, of course, came from La Liga, where things seem to be a little bit different. And I think, too, the results for Roma, I think against Barcelona, they were clearly the better team, and I thought it shouldn't have been as close. But my takeaway with Liverpool, that it probably shouldn't have been as close, but more on Liverpool side. Some other things that stood out to me, especially in the first half, I thought we had a great performance by El Shaarawy. I almost wanted to tweet it. Like, almost felt like even without Salah in the first half, Roma was going with the Egypt formation, so have a Pharaoh up front and 10 mummies behind them. But then the team did pick up a lot in the second half. I think, you know, the one consolation for Roma, if you had to lose to someone, in a way, losing to Salah going on to the final is a little bit of a silver lining. I think for Roma too, you know, obviously their brand as a whole got a lot of exposure, especially with, on the heels of what happened against Barcelona. The fact that the second leg at least was really exciting result-wise speaks very highly of them. I think too, their social media team absolutely hit a home run during this whole run in the Champions League. So great that they're getting recognized as well. I think that's great for Serie A as a whole to try to brand the league in a way in a little bit more of a modern way. So we want to congratulate Roma as a whole. Di Francesco, the players, was certainly a great one, and the social media team for the way they handled everything. You know, my takeaway in general from the Champions League for Serie A is I leave a lot more optimistic. When I even looking at the Real Madrid and Bayern, I really do think Juve can beat any team now. Assuming they keep most of this core moving forward on any pitch, I think they have to feel good about their chances moving forward. And Roma showed that Juve isn't necessarily the only team that can do well in Europe. So I think overall this has been a very good campaign for Serie A in the Champions League. I think we're seeing a tied also to the fact that we had an exciting title race up until last weekend. I think overall Serie A has to feel very good about how it's perceived compared to, say, a year ago. So more to come on this. We'll cover, of course, the final as it comes, but let's congratulate Roma for being another very exciting storyline for us on the podcast.
Yeah, they really did well. They definitely should hang their hats in a positive way. I mean, halfway through this season, we were saying, should they blow it up? And then obviously they did really, really well. And I got to think, if Cengiz Under, a player that was carrying them mid-season, if he was just in a little bit better form, maybe they really would have got past Liverpool. So, David, now we can say Thousand Names is not just a character of the show, but he's a guest of the show. So let's look ahead to the Serie A weekend. What do we have for game picks from you and Thousand Names?
So I have to say, Thousand Names was very excited by his appearance. He asked me if he could come on because we record on third. The reason we had him on a Monday is we record much earlier in the day. Thousand's based in Italy, but he had such a good time. He told me he'll come on a future Thursday episode just to do his picks. So as usual, he sent me three for the weekend. I'll read his, both in English and Italian, make my picks, and then tell you about a few other games going on. So the first one that he picked is Inter traveling to Friuli to play Udinese. His pick is Inter winning 1-0 with a goal by Icardi. His comment is Spalletti is going to get vindication for Inter on the 5th of May. Juve fans, Inter fans that have been following Serie A for a while know how significant that date is. Back in 2002, one of the craziest Scudetto races was decided on May 5th with Juve beating Udinese subsequent and Inter losing to Lazio, giving the title to Juve. So that is a thousands comment. So his comment is that Spalletti is going to vindicate that 5th of May, and he's going to send to hell all the Juve fans as well as Tudor, who is now the coach of Udinese, and he was in that match as well. But he's going to say that deep down, Inter's going to celebrate, but in their heart, they're still going to be crying about the mistakes Orsato, the referee, did in the previous match. So in Italian, Udinese Inter 0-1 Icardi, Spalletti vendica il 5 di maggio mandando all'inferno i Gobbi, Tudor e Giuliano, ma il cuore piange ancora per gli errori di Orsato. So Udinese was on an absolute free fall. They had lost, I think, 9 or 10 in a row with Oddo. Tudor got a draw in his first match. Inter, of course, played really well against Juve. They need a win just to keep whatever hopes they have for the Champions League. So I'm going to agree with Thousand. I'm going to give a 2-0 win to Inter with goals by Icardi and Perisic. Next up, we have Lazio-Atalanta. Interesting match, Champions League race, and Atalanta competing for a Europa League spot. I think you guys know by now that Lazio isn't one of Thousand Names' favorite teams. So his prediction is 2-2, goals by Milinkovic-Savic, Lulic, and a brace by Ilicic on Atalanta. He says that Simone Inzaghi is going to commit suicide and kiss goodbye the Champions League, and that he has a ridiculously bad defense. So in Italian, pronostico Lazio-Atalanta 2-2, Savic, Lulic, Ilicic, suicidio di Simone Inzaghi, addio Champions, difesa ridicola. I'm going to give a lot of credit for Atalanta for their season. We're going to get into them a little bit more with the questions, but I have Lazio winning this one. I'm going to have it 2-1. Now Immobile is going to be up. Our boy Milinkovic-Savic is having a great stretch. I'm going to give him a goal, and I'm going to give Felipe Anderson one. I'll give a goal to Barrow, who's been on fire in Atalanta, young player who's been performing really well. The last pick for Thousand Names, he has Napoli defeating Torino 6-0. Goals to braces by Insigne, Mertes, and Callejon. So the trio each get 2 goals. He says the San Paolo is going to be in tears to celebrate the success of the moral champions of Serie A, that Juve is going to be humiliated from a distance, and that Torino president Cairo is going to join the Scudetto party in Naples, and Torino is going to basically mail this in and make it as easy as possible for Napoli. So in Italian, Napoli Torino 6-0, Insigne, Mertens, Calegon, doppiette per tutti. San Paolo in lacrime per il successo dei campioni d'Italia morali, Juve umiliata a distanza, si unisce anche Cairo alla festa Scudetto, il Toro si scansa, fidatevi. I still think I agree that Napoli is going to win. This is actually Mazzarri's return to his former team. Mazzarri had gotten off to a good start at Torino, not so much recently. I'm not going to have it 6-0, but I'll give Napoli 3-1. Win. We can give Mertens, Milik, and Allan out of the blue. I'll give him a goal, and a goal by Belotti, who's trying to finish the season strong. A couple of other matches I want to bring to your attention. Juve's at home against Bologna. Fairly easy match on paper for them. Milan plays at home against Hellas Verona. Roma travels to Sardinia to play Cagliari. Cagliari is now in the relegation race as well. Two, to me, at this point, the race to avoid relegation is really, really exciting. Two matches I want to bring to your attention. Spal, who is competing to avoid relegation at home against Benevento, who's already relegated. And the game of the week for me is Chievo at home against Crotone. Huge implications for both teams. was interesting on Monday. Thousand Names says that he believes Chievo has really essentially waved the white flag by letting go of manager Maran and promoting their Primavera coach. It's like they're almost setting up next season in Serie B already. There might be something to what he says, because there's also, you do get a lot of money when you get relegated. So there's kind of some weird financial incentives with all this. So let's see what happens. But if Chievo wants to stay in Serie A, they absolutely need to win this match. So let's see how Thousand Names and I do with our picks. So to recap, we both agree Inter's going to win against Udinese. I have Lazio beating Atalanta, and we both agree that Napoli is going to defeat Torino. Now let's get to your Twitter questions. We've had some really good ones on Monday. We didn't answer them, so I appreciate some of these a little bit older. As always, keep these coming. You can send them in using the Calcioland hashtag. As always, Serie A. Now there's no more Champions League to talk about, but transfer season's getting closer and closer. Send us transfer questions for all leagues as well. And, you know, we also love getting questions on music and TV and films. So which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with this one. Why couldn't the Italian Federation find anyone better than Roberto Mancini to become the Azzurri's next manager?
It's a good question. And look, this week, all the momentum is for Mancini. It basically sounds like he has the job and they're going to announce it really soon. So look, you know, at this point, I just don't think the Italian national team job is as attractive as most people realize. Of course, the obvious thing is there's no World Cup. Anyone who's taken the job now, you know, is really focused more on the Euro. You know, I'm not sure if they're going to give Mancini a really long contract for him to start planning the next World Cup. So there's really just the Euro coming up next. Now, I know there's a lot of people that are high on a lot of the young Italian players. Look, you know, in general with prospects, I'm not as keen on them. I feel like it's so easy to project, you know, what a prospect is going to be based on our own biases and expectations. Shout out to Dre Cordero on that. I'm just not that crazy about prospects. I will tell you what's clearly obvious to me is there's a huge lack of talent up front for the Azzurri. There's no Totti, Del Piero, or even Luca Toni on the horizon. We talked about it on Monday, this tweet by this guy, Napoli Outsider, who I really like, who pointed out, you look at the standings for the most goals scored in Serie A, the three Italians at the top are Immobile, who's great in Serie A, but for the Italian national team has always been a big disappointment. And next up, we have players like Inglese and Pavoletti, certainly not the types of guy you want to build around. But I will say the silver lining, if Mancini gets the job, and at this point it seems pretty clear he will, is that to me that seems like Balotelli is going to come back to the Italian national team, obviously has a strong relationship with Mancini. And look, you know, had there be more talent at all, maybe I wouldn't want to deal with everything that comes with Balotelli, but at this point they need his talent. And I think the other thing that's really helped Mancini get the job is he has a strong relationship with Orreale, who is the team manager on the Azzurri, someone that's been a presence with the national team for a really long time. Mancini and Orreale work together at Inter. I think right now that there's such a vacuum of power with the federation, Orreale has a lot of say, so I think that helped Mancini. And look, you know, a lot of people have pointed out our friend Carlo Garganese, you know, how an uninspiring hiring this is. You know, Mancini wanted Inter during the Calciopoli scandal. When he wanted Manchester City, it was because of a collapse by Man United. And, you know, he didn't do well at Inter on his second go around. And I get it, tactically, he's not the best, but I have no reason to say why, but I'm kind of cautiously optimistic that Mancini could do okay. I know a lot of people point to, you know, Lippi and Sacchi and Trapattoni, like big name managers, but there's been other managers without a big profile that have done well on the Azzurri. Azzelio Vicini in the 90 World Cup got him to the semifinal without a mistake by Zenga. Maybe they win the whole thing. Dino Zoff and Cesare Maldini, you know, big names because of their playing days, but they weren't really that established managers. They did fairly well. So I think Mancini, you know, is kind of can be of kind of that ilk of Vicini, Zoff, Cesare Maldini type manager. But I think more than the manager, the problem for the Azzurri is a lack of talent. And I get it. A lot of you guys listening are high on the young players. I just need to see more to get more optimistic with that.
All right, David, next Twitter question. What do you make of multiple wingers being linked to Juventus, including Anthony Martial, when they have much bigger holes to fill in the midfield and at right back?
It's a great question. And look, you know, just because the media reports certain things, and, you know, I'm not here to take inventory of what other people do, that doesn't mean that those are the priorities for Juve. Look, Martial, there's been a lot of talk on him, you know, potentially leaving Manchester United. Obviously, Juve is a team that, you know, has done well with these kind of these reclamation projects and away from big clubs. Like even just look at Douglas Costa, someone along those lines. I think Juve looks at Martial more, you know, I think he's got just one more year left on his contract. So next season, more someone to look if it comes to the contract expiring. Like the listener pointed out, Juve needs to invest in the position of actual need. So the midfield and right back are higher priorities. So again, you know, keep in mind, sometimes what the media reports has more to do with the player than the club. And I think what you're reading on Martial has more to do with his situations than Juve's.
You know, I also got to think in terms of needs at midfield. The other day, Bayern Munich plays Real Madrid. Who starts for Bayern Munich? Quarantine Tolisso. So, and he was okay. He didn't stay in the whole game, but I just got to think, Juventus should have got Tolisso. I'm going to be stubborn and stick with that take. They could really use a nice player like him. To Bayern, he's just an accessory. He doesn't mean a whole lot. So moving on, David, will Max Allegri's experiment of Cuadrado at right back impact Juve's transfer plans?
It's an interesting question. So shout out to the person that sent it, my friend Martin Morgan, who's been supporting my work for a really long time. So huge shout out to him. I know there's quite a few people that have been reading me and support what I do for years, and I really appreciate it. I know who you are, especially you, Martin. So look, a lot of people have suggested that Juve try Cuadrado at, you know, at right back, right wing back. Look, you know, there's a lot nowadays. It's so rare to have a wing back that actually can defend. This is almost an offensive position. There are some that can do a little bit of both. So this is something that I think Juve should look at as well, maybe moving forward, especially because they have a lot of talent up front with Bernardeschi and Douglas Costa. And we've seen Cuadrado, how important he is to Juve now. Can we imagine him being a much worse defender than Dani Alves? Probably not. I think he could probably be in line with that. But when this question came up, you know, it kind of made me think, you know, another player that I think Juve fans might be underrating as someone who might be part of the future is Hoedes. And I know he's been injured a ton. He's on a loan with an option to buy that vests after a certain amount of games played. But Juve could work out a deal to keep him altogether. I wouldn't be surprised because of his versatility, because he can literally play everywhere on defense. If Juve doesn't try to bring him back next season in hopes that he is healthy, that's someone that's played at right back, left back, you know, with Germany in big games and can be a backup at center back. So when I got this question, I was like, let's just not think just of Cuadrado, but also Hoedes could be a player for Juve down the line.
All right, next one. Simply, David, who are Roma's summer transfer targets?
And look, you know, this is a great question. And I think, you know, so much of this changes because some of this news that we've had was some of it fairly recent, some from before. But I wonder how much Roma's plans change based on all the revenue they got from the Champions League. We talked about it with our friend John Solano last week. And, you know, he's pretty optimistic that this might be one summer where Roma doesn't have to actually sell any big names. So one player that they were linked to is this young Swedish keeper called Marco Johansson, and he was seen as a potential replacement for Alisson, thinking that Alisson could be the sacrificial lamb. But Roma's financial situation is better, so maybe they can keep Alisson. And maybe some of the targets for the midfield on the Marzio side, we've linked them to Brian Cristante on Atalanta and Pryet on Sampdoria. You know, those are good players. Maybe now with more revenues, Roma can be a little bit more aggressive. Me personally, I know I've advocated them blowing it up, and then they did so well in the Champions League and did better in Serie A, almost securing a spot in the Champions in the spot for the Champions League next season. But I do think Roma still has to look at bringing in some more young legs. I think Strootman would be a player if they can get a good offer for him, sell him. I think Nainggolan, although he had two goals yesterday, his value has really dropped so much that I don't know if you can get a good return for him. But in general, I think Roma should look, especially in the midfield, to bring more young legs. I don't know how much more we can expect for De Rossi. So far, I know these aren't a ton of names, but let's see what happens. Maybe they go back to some other players that they had gone for in the past, like Mahrez of the world, players like that. But I think for Roma, too, let's not underestimate the fact that Karsdorp, a player that they invested significantly in, has suffered two injuries. He'd almost be like a new acquisition for them. We've seen some positive signs from Schick recently, so maybe Roma can also improve with the players they already have on the squad.
All right, this next question is refreshing. We don't often talk about some of these teams. David, have there been any rumors of Laxalt potentially joining Atalanta to replace Spinazzola?
So shout out to our friends, the Las Vegas Atalanta Supporters Club. They're great supporters of the podcast. They sent us questions. I want to give them a shout out. And this is a great question because, look, Atalanta has been linked to Laxalt. For those of you that aren't that familiar with him, he's the left wing back on Genoa, has been quite good, had been linked to Chelsea as well in the past, and he has been linked to Atalanta. Last year, if you guys remember, when Juve was trying to bring back Spinazzola, Laxalt looked like the player that would replace him. But in the meantime, I think Laxalt has continued to play really well. I could see him maybe go into a bigger team than Atalanta in the future. So that's no knock on Atalanta. And another thing is, look, you know, one of the reasons why I'm a pretty bullish on Marcos Alonso and players like that is that the left back position is so scarce on the transfer market. It's so hard to find good ones. So I could see Laxalt being a name, with all due respect to Atalanta, like a higher profile could be going after them. On the bright side for Atalanta today, they posted some very impressive financial results. They're turning in a profit of over $27 million for the fiscal year. So very well done on their part. So maybe Atalanta is going to be even more aggressive moving forward. Definitely a club that deserves a lot of credit for how they're run.
All right, well, let's stay on Atalanta. Given their modest payroll, is it fair to say that Atalanta has had the best season of the mid-table teams in Serie A?
It's hard to argue against that because Atalanta also did well in the Europa League. You know, I know they got eliminated before Lazio, but they have done really quite well. What a season for them. They've juggled competing in multiple competitions very well. So not only did, as a mid-table team, did they do very well, they also juggled it while playing in Europe. So a lot of credit to Gasperini. As I mentioned in the question before, we might see Atalanta's profile be raised because they're in a better financial situation. So they could even keep building on this. You know, another team I want to give to a shout out is Fiorentina. They had sold a ton of players, dealt, of course, with the Astori situation. I want to give them a shout out. Sampdoria, I think, as usual, has done well after selling a lot of players. But I'm going to give the edge to Atalanta because on top of doing well in Serie A, they also did well in European competitions.
All right, David, let's move away from football. How popular would Oasis be had Be Here Now not been such a dud?
So it's a great question. So, you know, Oasis, in Europe, outside of the U.S., were really a massive band. Like Oasis, if they were to do a reunion, like right now, if they played in Europe, they'd sell out stadiums like no problem and really, really quickly. Here in the U.S., that has never been the case. But I think they had a great opportunity when Be Here Now came out because their previous album, Morning Glory, had two huge singles even here in the U.S. Of course, Wonderwall, Don't Look Back in Anger, like an album with a lot of hits. And I think there was a lot of momentum for Oasis being the English band who kind of crossed over here and done really well. But that album, Be Here Now, was a major dud. You know, I remember I was in college. I remember really well when that album came out. I know a lot of you follow Kat, the Milan fan, Catherine, on Twitter. She was essentially my college roommate back then. And I remember when this album came out, there was a lot of buzz and excitement for it, I guess, based on the fact that Oasis' previous album had done so well. But it ended up being really a massive disappointment. When Rick James used to say cocaine's a hell of a drug, this album really is an example of this, of someone really losing their mind and really taking themselves way too serious. I think Noel Gallagher had written some really good melodies. Some of these songs had some good melodies, but they were incredibly long. Really, things got lost in the shuffle. I think there was terrible production on this album. I think with a good producer and someone trying to center them, making the songs a little bit shorter, it could have been a lot better. So it's a great question. I do think Oasis' popularity in the U.S. could have really skyrocketed had that album been better, but it didn't hurt them in Europe, because in Europe they were always huge, and I think they would still be if they got back together.
All right, last Twitter question. Which bands, David, would you recommend for a person getting into rock music?
Well, you know, if you know me, when this question came in, this almost kept me up at night, because I take this really seriously. And look, you know, I'm old. I turned 41 not that long ago. When I was growing up, rock music was really the music. Nowadays, that is not the case. Hip-hop, techno, all that stuff. The young people are much more into it. I'm not saying rock is dead, but it's not the most important musical genre. So it's great that someone asked, you know, I want to get into rock music. What should I do? So I do have some bands, but I have to say, if an alien landed in my backyard and tell me, hey, Dave, what's rock and roll all about? What I would play is Guns N' Roses song, Mr. Brownstone. For me, that has everything about what a great rock song is. It has the attitude, great riff, lyrics that that are about drugs, but really about the rock and roll lifestyle. So if I had to play, if I wanted to tell someone you want to get into rock music, start with that. All of Guns N' Roses albums, I think, are really good description of what a classic rock band is. If you want to go back to before Guns N' Roses, bands that, of course, really influenced them, like the Rolling Stones, to me, are ultimately the best rock band ever. I would say the Beatles, but they're really more of like pop music. I have a hard time defining the Beatles as a straight up rock band, although they definitely had some rock songs. But the Rolling Stones really are the definition of what a rock band is all about. They really set the blueprint of a band that was dangerous. You didn't know what they were going to do. Drugs, just the lifestyle, a lead singer in competition with his guitarist. Like, we've had the drama between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. We've seen that over and over again with a lot of other bands. So the Rolling Stones really are the blueprint for what a rock band's all about. If you want to start with their greatest hits, go ahead with that. But there's some great albums. Exile on Main Street is terrific. That's one of the best rock albums ever. Other bands you should get into, of course, Led Zeppelin, a blues-influenced band. Same with AC/DC. A lot of their older albums really set the blueprint. And another one that I would recommend is Queen, because, they're not my favorite band, but they definitely brought another element to rock music, more of an opera sign to it, an amazing frontman with Freddie Mercury. So my answer, you want to get into rock music, I would go with Guns N' Roses, Rolling Stone, Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, and Queen. If you like those, then you can tell me I like this the most, and I can recommend some other ones. So thank you all, guys, for the Twitter questions. You guys have been really, really supportive. We appreciate it. Keep reviewing the podcast and leaving ratings. I really appreciate it. That's actually one of the first things I do in the morning, is go check where we're at with that. We're closing in on 200 reviews just for the U.S., we get a lot of reviews in other countries too, so it helps us a lot. If you're listening to us on iTunes, please leave us a 5-star rating. Literally takes 2 seconds. If you want to leave us a comment, we really appreciate it. So without further ado, we recorded this interview with Grant Wall a few weeks ago. The reason we recorded it, his book came out this week. We wanted to release the interview when the book was out so you could get it. We got into a great discussion. We talked a little bit about Roma Liverpool, but well before the game. I think you'll understand kind of why the question's still relevant today. We got into some great topics on MLS, even Balotelli potentially coming here. For those of you that aren't familiar with Grant Wall, like, he is the most famous soccer journalist here in the U.S. Like, he's very humble, but he is a great guy, big supporter of the show. I finished reading his book that he sent me, Masters of Modern Soccer. It's really outstanding, and we'll get into it in the interview towards the end. So if you read it, let me know your thoughts, but I think you'll really enjoy it. And I'm thrilled to be joined with an exciting guest for our podcast, my good friend Grant Wall. For you in the United States, you are obviously very familiar with his work. He's probably the premier soccer writer in the U.S. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. You can see him on Fox Sports TV. He is the host of the fantastic Planet Football podcast, and you can see him more and more on SITV. The reason I'm excited that Grant is back on the podcast, for one, the first time I had him on, that's when I think my producer Alex knew that we were going to be a legitimate show. I think he didn't believe that Grant would ever come on our podcast, and he did. And now Grant's back on because his book is coming out, his second book. He had previously written a fantastic book on Beckham called The Beckham Experiment, and his new book, The Masters of Modern Soccer, is out in May of this year. And we'll get into that in the second part of the interview. So, Grant, it's a real pleasure to chat with you. Welcome back to Cultureland.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back, David. It was a pleasure to go on the first time. Glad to be back a second time, and congratulations on everything you've done with the podcast.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So, Grant, I'm going to cheat our listeners. We recorded this a little bit before you're hearing it, but one of the things that I wanted to ask you, Grant, as people hear this, we will have seen Roma and Liverpool play in the Champions League semifinal, which I think, you know, it's surprising, I think, for most fans. But, you know, I'm based in Boston. I'm chatting with you from Boston. And the two ownership groups of the teams are actually based here in Boston. And Grant, you know, is very familiar with soccer here in the United States, very familiar with football in Europe and how these two worlds connect. So I wanted to ask you, Grant, these two groups, I know, especially in Italy, I'm very familiar with a lot of the problems that Pallotta's had in the city of Rome, but I suspect in Liverpool there's been a little bit about the same with the John Henry. So tell me, in your opinion, which of these two groups is more vindicated by the success we've seen from their club this season, or is it both of them?
I mean, it's a great question, and honestly, I think you can make a great case for either one when you look at the path of their sort of ownership situations with these clubs. And there are certainly some similarities about what Henry with Liverpool and Pallotta with Roma are trying to do at these very traditional clubs in terms of bringing some, maybe some American-like ideas in terms of either building a new stadium in Roma's case or totally updating Anfield in Liverpool's case. You know, I think what they finally decided to do with Liverpool was to do something similar to what they did with Fenway Park. Update parts of it, but also take the experience of a game day outside of the formal stadium into some of the streets around as well. And so, you know, it's taken a little longer, I think, for Roma's stadium situation to get where they want it to be, though it sounds like some progress is being made. And there's clearly a realization that they have to increase revenues if they want to be in the position to reach the Champions League semifinals every year, or, you know, if they don't do it, at least to be in a position to do it. And, you know, in Europe, that's a money situation. So I like what these clubs have done, Liverpool and Roma, these owners, these U.S.-based owners, to show respect for the traditions of what these clubs are, while also trying to do the things financially to put them in a better position to compete in leagues that don't have salary caps.
Yeah, I think the Fenway analogy is a really, really good one, because when they took over here, I mean, in Boston, it was almost a lot of people thought they'd do a new stadium, and I think the decision to stay ended up really, really paying off. So very interesting analysis there. Now, another player I wanted to ask you about is someone you're very familiar with. So a few years ago, you did a cover story for SI with Mario Balotelli. Really, I think I followed all of Mario's career. We spoke about it before. To me, that was one of the best interviews with him. And recently, you've reported of the interest of DC United potentially in bringing him here to MLS. So, of course, you know the league incredibly well. We've seen the example of Jovinko, you know, leaving Europe Europe while he was still in his prime. So if you hypothetically were talking to Balotelli, I know the two of you are still in touch here or there. If he were to ask you, what are the pros and cons of a potential move to DC United, what would you tell him?
Well, you know, I think when you look at what Stavinko's done, you can make an argument that he is the best foreign signing in the history of MLS. In terms of his performance on the field. And he made the decision to come to MLS in his 20s. And that's where MLS is going. But also, I think the European player is moving in a different direction to where more of them, like Jovinko, might be willing to come to MLS at an earlier stage in their career. Now, what I would say to Balotelli is, if you're wanting to have a national team future, then I think you should think twice or think really hard yep. about coming to MLS, because I think what Jovinko has found is that it's very hard to be part of the national team. If, you know, it used to be if you weren't playing in Italy. Now it's if you're, you know, playing in North America. I think that has probably hurt Jovinko's chances, which is unfortunate because I think Jovinko's level is good enough to be with the Italian national team. But that's one thing I would say to Balotelli. But I also think Mario would be a great fit for MLS and, you know, an entertainment type situation where, you know, I'm talking about scoring goals, but also about providing interesting things to say to the media and getting people to really follow things. And I think that Balotelli would be a great companion in a way for Ibrahimovic as he has come into the league. Another guy who is older than Balotelli, but still seems to have it, at least so far, and who brings that entertainment on and off the field. Now, what DC is a great fit for Balotelli, I don't know. He's always seemed to me to be more of a New York, LA guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, that's also potentially the next step of MLS, is to have teams outside of the typical places getting star players. And DC United clearly has more interest in star players than they did before. They have their new stadium opening up this summer, and part of my report last week is DC United is going to go from one designated player to three this summer as part of going into that stadium. And that's why they've been talking to Mino Raiola about Balotelli and talking to a few other players as well.
Very, very interesting. So you mentioned, of course, Zlatan Ibrahimovic. You've been doing a lot of reporting on the negotiations with the Galaxy. And you had a very, very interesting report on how much money Ibrahimovic actually left on the table to come here. And what I mean by that isn't the contract he rescinded with Manchester United, but more importantly, a big offer from China. So tell our listeners who might not be familiar with what you reported on this, how much money did Ibrahimovic actually leave on the table to come here?
So the guy who signed Ibrahimovic for LA Galaxy was Jovan Kurowski, the former U.S. international. He's now the technical director for LA. And Kurowski told me that Ibrahimovic turned down a contract from a Chinese club post-injury, so in the last year, that would have paid him total $100 million over the length of the contract. Now, Kurowski didn't know how many years the contract was, you know, the length was, but this was right around, I'm assuming right around the time Carlos Tevez was getting big money in China before he ended up leaving, because actually in the last few months, the Chinese contract offers have gone down a bit for players. But if that is the case, what Kurowski was saying, then that means Ibrahimovic left $97 million on the table. And because he's going to LA and literally his salary is just $1.5 million over this 2-year contract, because that is the most money you can pay to a player you've acquired with targeted allocation money, which is one of the various MLS mechanisms. But what it means is that he's not a designated player. When you a player whose salary can be unlimited, you can only have 3 designated players per team. LA already had 3. So that's what's fascinating to me is that Ibrahimovic and Mino Raiola were willing to sign for such a little amount of money when clearly he could have gotten a lot more money elsewhere.
Very, very interesting. And that's kind of a, you know, sometimes Raiola, I think a lot of times gets a bad rap, but I think, you know, when it comes to getting his clients to where they want to go, he's a really a master, and it's not necessarily always about the biggest offer or whatnot. So very interesting there. So I wanted to ask your take on the Ibrahimovic signing, because obviously he brings a ton of eyeballs to the league. His debut, everyone was talking about it for sure. But I wanted to see if you think this is even important, how his arrival in a way kind of re-energizes a take and a narrative that I found to be definitely inaccurate and outdated, that MLS is really a league where a lot of stars like Ibrahimovic come to retire. Like, I wasn't a huge expert in MLS. Like, they got me with Pirlo. I got into the league, and little by little, I started saying, you know, there's a lot more to this league, and I really started enjoying the matches once I started comparing so much to Europe. So give me your take on that. Is that something even important to the league, or fans of the league should be concerned of, with the narrative of how the league could be perceived by people who, quite frankly, don't know much about it?
Yeah, I think you still have this opinion with a lot of folks, especially in Europe, but in other places too, that MLS is a, quote, retirement league. And everything over the last 3 years or so suggests that that is not the case anymore with MLS. Just when you look at the trends of the signings, I don't know the exact numbers. It was like the last 35 or 36 designated player signings in MLS, only one of those 35 or 36 players was over the age of 30, and that was Schweinsteiger with Chicago.
Yeah.
And so what we are seeing instead is players in their teens and their 20s being signed to designated player contracts. I think Atlanta is the team that more than any other has been representative of this trend, where their three designated players that they started out with last year were all 23 or under, all players from South America who have terrific futures, and they perform for Atlanta really well on the field. And you don't need to anymore get a player like Steven Gerrard or Frank Lampard to come in and just try to do that to sell tickets. And those guys, you know, I have a lot of respect for them, but they didn't really perform all that well. It's a difficult league where you're doing a ton of travel. It's a lot of running in this league. And if you're not ready for it, you won't do well. And so I like the fact that we're seeing these exciting rising talents, many of them from South America, like Ezequiel Barco, the $15 million transfer league record from Independiente in Argentina, goes to Atlanta this year instead of going, like he would have in the past, directly to Europe. He's just 19 years old. And Diego Rossi out at LAFC, coming from Peñarol in Uruguay, he's off to a terrific start this season. And so this has been a lot of fun, I think, for us to watch these young, exciting players in MLS. And yes, there are a few older ones too. Some of them are doing quite well, like David Villa still with NYCFC. Yeah. And it's a really good mix of players now. But yeah, I think retirement league, if you actually watch these games in MLS, that's not the words you would use.
Yeah, without a doubt, that has certainly been my experience. So to kind of reinforce this notion that Zlatan, in a way, is kind of an outlier of what the league is doing, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions or what I think are the most exciting storylines in MLS. So I recently, about a month ago, I had Alexi Lalas on the podcast. And, you know, he played for my hometown team, Padova, the first North American in Serie A, and he was playing there when Serie A was the league in the world. And I asked him if he thought the Toronto FC could beat that Padova team, and he had no doubt. He said the current Toronto FC could absolutely beat us. So I wanted to get your take on this, not necessarily on the Padova Serie A aspect, but in general, how do you think the current Toronto FC team could compete in Europe? So let's say in England or Spain, which a lot of people seem to think are probably the toughest leagues, do you think they'd be able to avoid relegation or even might be a little bit more, you know, ambitious than that? So give me your take, because you follow MLS really well and you're incredibly familiar with the football in Europe as well.
Yeah, I think Toronto would be toward the bottom of those top leagues in England and Spain, for example. But I think they could certainly compete to stay up. When you look at Toronto, their payroll is around $25 million per year as a team, which is obviously more than MLS used to spend on team payrolls. And I think beyond that, I think they actually play so well together, this Toronto team, and have for a while now, that their chemistry makes them worth more than a $25 million a year team. I really like the way that the star players have come together, but the role players have come together. And, you know, we've seen it in CONCACAF Champions League. This is not like any MLS team you've seen before. And there have been some good MLS teams over the years, but I think this is the best that the league has ever had. And they've proved it on the field. They've been better than the top teams in Mexico.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty excited just to see them get to the FIFA Club World Cup and see if they have a crack at some of these teams from other parts of the world, because I like what Toronto has done with their ambition from their ownership, but also from their players. And it's not just about spending money, though I think that's part of it. There just seems to be a kind of Toronto way to approach playing this game the right way and getting the results you need. And they're a fun team to watch, too.
Yeah, without a doubt, a very, very exciting team. So the other storyline that really stands out to me in MLS is what's going on in Atlanta. So some of our listeners, even maybe not those based in the U.S., might have seen videos of Atlanta's home games. Now, they share a stadium with the Atlanta Falcons, so they have a huge stadium, and they pack in often over 70,000 people in the stadium. It's incredible. I was down in Atlanta last year, and I was blown away by how much buzz there is in the city for soccer. There's advertising there everywhere. A good friend of mine, Aaron West, did an amazing reporting on the explosion of a soccer culture and with African American communities. Like, really amazing what's going on there. Now, Atlanta, you know, is also a city that's really having a great revival beyond soccer. So I wanted to ask you if you think there are some things that are working in Atlanta that could work in other cities in the U.S. to make MLS grow, or if you think they're a little bit of an outlier.
You know, I think what we've seen with Atlanta is absolutely amazing, because Atlanta is a city that has never been seen as even being a good sports city. Their fans in other sports have always been thought of as being sort of bandwagon jumpers. When they're pretty good and when they're not very good, they don't go, or just not having many fans at all. And soccer pre-Atlanta United didn't do very well in Atlanta. As recently as just a few years ago, they had a second division team that didn't draw at all. And so what's happened here is, I think, a lot of factors coming together and creating this perfect storm of success for Atlanta in its first couple of years in MLS, where you've got an owner, Arthur Blank, who's also the owner of the Falcons, who is a tremendously ambitious owner, spends a lot of money, built this remarkable stadium, but did so not, it's built just as much for soccer as it is for American football. And hiring smart people, whether it's people in the front office like Darren Eales from Tottenham, or whether it's the coach, Tata Martino, or Barcelona and Paraguay coach, to, you know, making the right player signings and really catering to a young professional audience in Atlanta that has embraced soccer. And some of that is international community that has moved to Atlanta in recent years, but some of that is also just young professionals who want to have a good time following soccer. And I think there's really been almost a positive viral contagion towards soccer in Atlanta the last couple of years. And so you see that on TV. I haven't been down there in person yet, so I want to get down there soon. The MLS All-Star game will be there August 1st, so that may be when I do it. But and they've got a good team on the field. They got to the playoffs first year. They're fun to watch. Miguel Almirón may not be there that long, but you have a feeling now that they'll, when they do sell him for a lot of money, that they'll replace him with someone who has a ton of potential. And so there's that. If you're MLS and you're looking at other cities, you know, this is somewhat similar to what happened in Seattle when they came into MLS, somewhat similar to Portland, but Seattle and Portland had more history in the NASL than Atlanta did. And there was a little bit more organic soccer history, whereas Atlanta has just kind of come out of nowhere. MLS is going to go to Nashville before too long here, and that's it may not be 70,000 fans per game, Atlanta in Nashville, but I think that has a really good chance of succeeding. And then I think there's a question about Miami and David Beckham's team coming in there, because it is going to happen apparently, but Miami is another tough town, kind of like Atlanta for sports over the years. And so I'm very curious to see how that goes. But what I would say about Miami is it's a city that likes stars, and anything owned by David Beckham is going to have stars on it. And Miami has also become much more of a South American city in recent years than just a Cuban city. And I know the old stereotype that, Cubans like baseball, not soccer. I get it. But there's a lot of people in Miami now from Brazil and Colombia and Argentina and other parts of their community. I love Miami, and I think they do have a chance to succeed as long as they are smart about it. Now, the most interesting story in MLS in terms of, like, how do you change a city in their response to soccer, to me, is Kansas City, where I'm from, where they actually went from having an original MLS team that was not popular at all and playing in a nearly empty NFL stadium to building a soccer stadium, and now they sell out every game every Saturday night. And MLS is an outlier in MLS. I mean, we really haven't seen any original MLS cities aside from Kansas City do a total turnaround like that. And to be honest, that's what MLS needs in places like Columbus if they decide to stay there, or Dallas or Denver. To me, those are probably bigger challenges right now than any new expansion cities coming in.
Very, very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about your book, because this is a really great topic. So I've mentioned in the past, that you interviewed Balotelli. You've interviewed a lot of very famous soccer players. We'll use the word since your book is based on that. You interviewed Company, Xabi Alonso, Michael Neuer, Chicharito, obviously Pulisic, the rising star in American soccer. So I want to ask you, you have all these experiences interviewing and getting to know people really at the top of the game. And it seems like the question that you're really trying to answer in the book is, how do they prepare and how have they mastered their craft? So tell me how you went about deciding that this was the right idea for your next book, and how did you develop that?
Well, the book is essentially about the craft of soccer position by position. So I wanted to get one player from each position on the field, and then a manager and a director of football. And I wanted to find a person to represent each position who is not only world-class or close to it, but also really intelligent at explaining how they approach the craft of their position, what they do. And so I spent a long time just trying to figure out to myself, like, who are the people to approach to try and get to participate in the book? And so I had like a list of guys for each position, and I got my top choice on almost every one. And to be honest, even when I didn't get my top choice, I felt really good about who I got in the end. I really am happy about the different voices in this book. So, what I did was I spent 2 years doing interviews over in Europe, multiple times with each of these figures. So it's, Manuel Neuer, you mentioned the goalkeeper, Vincent Kompany is the defender, Xabi Alonso is the defensive midfielder, Christian Pulisic is the attacking midfielder, Javier Chicharito Hernandez is the forward, Roberto Martinez, the Belgian manager, is the manager, and Michael Zorc, the Dortmund sporting director, is the director of football. And these guys were so educational to me, and I stepped out of my comfort zone a little bit for this book because I didn't play at a extremely high level in soccer. And I do think that while I have always felt comfortable analyzing a game for Sports Illustrated, I've done that for 22 years, I still think there are some things that you can only learn by playing the game at a really high level, living it. And that was part of my goal in this book, was in these interviews to talk to these guys and watch extensive video with each of them about how do you look at a game? You know, in this position, what are you thinking? Like, while we're watching the video and all of these different aspects of their job. And all of these interviews, the term modern soccer, modern football, kept coming up. Mm. And if I asked Vincent Kompany, for example, what do you think of the term modern football? What does that mean to you? And he would talk for like 10 minutes. And just about every guy in this book would do that. And you could tell how much they think the game. And so that's why it's called Masters of Modern Soccer, this idea that today's sport is very different from, if you see like a video of the 1970 World Cup final, it's an amazing game, but it's also, it almost looks like a completely different sport.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's not nearly as much defensive pressure. The game doesn't move quite as fast. There's more attacking players in 1970. And so talking about all of these differences about the modern game and how you approach it was really, really interesting for me. And just hearing from these guys, you know, how the modern game requires you to be proficient at not just sort of the traditional skills. Like if you're Manuel Neuer, you're not just about shot stopping. You've got to be the guy. He's so innovative. And so we talked about how he became a sweeper keeper and why he ended up coming out so far from his goal outside his box to break up plays for so long. And hearing it from these guys who are so intelligent was really an experience I'll treasure. And I hope that comes through on the page for people who read it.
Well, I'm sure it does. So I was actually really fascinated because obviously I like how you went position by position. You also assembled a pretty badass 5-on-5 team with your selections there. But I really find it fascinating that you also wanted to get a manager and a sporting director's perspective. So tell me why you decided to incorporate that. And is there maybe some time where maybe they have a different time frame for the development of a player? You know, and some coaches have not much time at a club. So I wanted to see kind of what perspective you got from them. And was that maybe different than how players look at it?
It is different. You know, my manager is Roberto Martinez, who obviously managed Everton, Wigan, and is now with the Belgian national team. He could win the World Cup this summer. He's got a team that's good enough to do it. And, you know, what was fascinating was when I first started interviewing Roberto Martinez, he was still the Everton manager. And then he got fired. And my first reaction was, oh, no, this is horrible. Not just for him, but for my book. And then he got the Belgian job. And actually, one of the really interesting aspects of the Roberto Martinez chapter is to hear him talk in detail about the compare and contrast between being a club manager and a national team manager, and how it took him a while to get used to the different metabolism level, I guess. You know, when you're a national team coach, you only have your players once every several months. And yet the time you have with them is very concentrated. And obviously you have very talented players when you're with them. So that part was really interesting to me. And then Michael Zorc, the sporting director, the director of football for Dortmund, is viewed as the gold standard in many ways, along with Monchi at Roma, among directors of football today in Europe. And so this gets into sort of the role of like Billy Beane and Moneyball, which is the identification of talent and figuring out how to take advantage of the market. And one thing that Zorc has been able to do so well is to buy low and sell high on so many players who we know very well from watching European soccer. And his track record is amazing. Just, I have a whole list, a table in the book of guys he's bought. And I mentioned how much he bought them for, and then I mentioned how much he sold them for. And it's amazing his track record. And what he would say, and he does say in the chapter, is that he has a ton of respect for Monchi and what he did at Sevilla and now Roma. But he points out that at Dortmund, he's also required not just to buy low and sell high, but to win trophies. And his point was that Monchi didn't necessarily have that pressure in La Liga. He may have it more now at Roma to actually win the league. So that all of that was a really fascinating discussion for me with a guy like Zorc, who's been in demand by so many other clubs in Europe. Arsenal's tried to hire him a couple of times and failed. And he really is a guy who grew up in the Dortmund area, played his entire career there, and looks like he'll probably stay there for his entire administrative career, too.
I'm really looking forward to all our listeners reading this and sharing their feedback on the podcast, because we love these sorts of chats. So the last question that I have is, last time we had you on, we had a very nice discussion on your career in journalism. You shared great tips, and you know, a lot of our listeners are aspiring writers. So you mentioned this book was a long process. You put a lot of time into it. So I want to ask you, what was one lesson that you learned from this book? I have a feeling it could be many. It could be a lot of different subjects. It could be on how you improved your writing, how you improved the way you interviewed someone, or maybe something that these people do to master their craft at soccer that you can apply to another craft. So share with me one thing that really stood out to you that you learned throughout the process of the book.
For me, one thing that really stood out was probably that so many of these players who are so accomplished, who've won World Cups, who've won UEFA Champions Leagues, even going into their 30s, guys like Vincent Kompany and Xabi Alonso and Manuel Neuer all say that they're still learning, that here are guys who have had so much success, they could just say, I don't need to learn anything else. I've achieved everything. And these guys do not. Constantly, they're reinventing themselves, learning more about the game. And I don't think it was a coincidence that Alonso, Kompany, and Neuer have all played in recent years in their 30s for Pep Guardiola. And each one of those guys talked to me about how Pep Guardiola had, how much he had taught them, how he's different from even other managers when it comes to paying such close attention to the details of positioning on the field. And so Kompany has this really long quote where he gets into total detail about Guardiola telling him, or a player next to him, that he's like basically a foot or two from where he needs to be and why that's a huge difference. And we'll literally like pick the player up and like move him over like 1 foot. And so the reverence that these players have for Guardiola, I find fascinating, but it also goes along with continuing to educate yourself about the game. And so that really stood out to me, where even though I didn't interview Pep Guardiola for this book, I feel like his presence is everywhere in this book through these players talking about his influence.
So, Grant, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. Best of luck for the book, everyone. It's called Masters of Modern Soccer. You can get it on Amazon, iTunes, wherever you get books. I hope we gave you a sense of all the great work Grant put into this. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it.